Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest exciting, and I mean really exciting, adventure from life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the redoubtable, irrepressible, rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. And Miss Jones, I think I'm right in saying you are fresh from celebrating the Chinese New Year.
Gung Hei Fat Choi.
Gung Hei Fat Choi. Sorry, I didn't know that I'd done anything to upset you lately.
That's what we always say in Chinese New Year, which is basically Happy Lunar New Year.
Right.
I've got a lot of wonderful Malaysian Chinese friends who date back to when we were about 17, long, long time. And when we lived in the big former family home for 21 years, we always hosted a big Chinese New Year party, which all the men did the cooking. So they would all come with, you know, pre-prepared things. They're brilliant cooks, these guys. Yeah. And then they would finish them off in my kitchen, and the women would do the desserts and lay the table and everything. And then we'd have karaoke. And we always had a professional karaoke machine delivered that a guy would come round and set up, and then everybody would get up and have a go. And such a wonderful celebration, a really big part of my kids' childhood, you know. So last night we were reduced just to the four of us, just me and my three children, and we go to this big place in New Cross and have the feast.
New Cross? I thought you might have gone to Chinatown in London near Covent Garden.
No, too busy really. And where everybody's living sort of in different parts of London now. And it's a favourite old place. I used to take them there when they were kids, you know. But yeah, we had a lovely evening. It was not the same, but life moves on and nothing stays the same. We just have to get used to that, don't we?
I totally agree. I was born in December, December 29th. What year is that? Is that the year of the lion or the dog or something?
Oh, I don't know. Do you not know your Chinese?
No, no. I mean, what year is this year? You must know that because you're celebrating.
This is the year of the tiger.
Year of the tiger. I like that. And it's just, the eye of the tiger. Yeah, I like it. Yeah.
That's what Mia started singing last night, my eldest. But I'm a monkey. I think that there's something in... I am a monkey.
Yeah.
You know, there is something in the Chinese astrology that matches, it's really quite uncanny. It matches the personality of the person who gets that animal. So I'm a monkey. Both my daughters are rabbits.
Right.
Because they're born 12 years apart. And the calendar, the Chinese astrology calendar works on a 12-year cycle.
Oh.
So they just happen to have been
both
born
in the
12
same
years
year.
Apart.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting, yeah. Well, if it goes on, if the animal that represents your birth year also represents your character and personality, I must be a lion because I'm king of the jungle, you know what I mean?
But there isn't a lion, so you probably would be a tiger.
Tiger, yeah.
What was your year of birth?
54.
1954. I'll look it up for you afterwards.
That's good.
I'll tell you what you are.
Let me know. Great. Now, I think I've been very clever here, Miss Jones. We're both musically minded, aren't we? So when I noticed that the star attraction at Leeds United is now a young lad footballer, 20 years of age, I think he is, called Jake Harrison, who recently scored a hat-trick for them. I thought to myself, Harrison, you've got to celebrate that name. So I've actually written an improvisation of a famous George Harrison song, and I'm going to sing it to you now. This is a world first, okay? So our millions of...
A world exclusive. World exclusive. Oh, wow.
Millions of our listeners listening to this will hear this now for the first time, but I bet within days, if not weeks, it'll be reverberating around football grounds where Blackburn Rovers are playing, and it goes like this. Something in the way he shoots attracts me like no other striker. Something in the way he boots the ball, he's going to score tonight. I know that he's going to be right. Da, 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 da. How about that? I think that's great.
Well, listen, I think that deserves a round of applause.
Thank you.
You heard it here first.
Absolutely,
thanks.
Absolutely, yeah.
You might have a bit of copyright issue with
George
Olivia
Harrison. Yeah, I might do.
Well, with Olivia, I should think. Well, in fact, you'd have that with not only Olivia, but with Yoko and with Paul McCartney.
No, you're right. The Harrison Estate. You've got to be very careful about these things. Sometimes when I do a TV show and I break into song, I get an immediate instruction from the director to shut up because they have to pay royalties on it.
It's the public performance rights. Yeah. So every time somebody bursts into song,
that's right.
They do have to pay. They have an arrangement. They have a license, in fact.
It's not unsubstantial because I came off the set once and the director came over to me and said, Mike, in future, I said, what's the problem? He said, you burst into song on Rad Stewart. I said, yeah. I said, I do that all the time on the radio. He said, this is not radio. He said, that costs us £150, even if you only utter three words of a Rod Stewart song or something,
And they're very hot on it these days.
Yes, they
are. Because obviously everything is digitised. So they can monitor it so easily.
Yeah.
All places that play or perform music have to have a licence. So even if you're the tiniest little backstreet hairdresser or a little garage who has a radio on your forecourt, playing to the mechanics while they're fixing up somebody's engine, they will need a license.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. On radio, you get away with it a lot more because it's I don't know why, but it's not such a big market and it's regarded as a flippant comment rather than a camera focusing on you. You know what I mean? But one time, the creative department at one radio station I worked at decided to do a trail based on Thriller, Michael Jackson's Thriller, and probably about two lines of it, the music. I got a letter from a lawyer in New York from Sony threatening a $50 million lawsuit if we ever played it again.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how, sensitive they are, as you've just explained, to the ownership.
You'd have to be really thick to play it again. I mean, they're basically flagging up to you that they are not going to earn $50,000 out of you.
No, exactly, 50 million.
50 million.
Yeah, but there we are. What do you think of Ronaldo as a boyfriend when he takes his girlfriend to, I think it's Dubai, where the world's biggest building is, the Burj, I can never pronounce the name of it.
Burj Khalifa,
well done. And then as they're sitting there in the restaurant, says, look at that, darling. And he manages to have her image transferred onto the length of the hotel. I mean, that is quite something, isn't it?
Well, it is. But there's obviously an ulterior story to this because there is to absolutely everything. Mm. She's got her own Netflix reality TV series just starting called I Am Georgina. Yeah. And it's a real rags-to-riches thing. She used to work in a shop in Spain. That's how they met.
Yeah.
And she's pregnant with his twins, all of this. It wasn't just a birthday message. This is the most prominent display screen in the entire world. Mm. And for somebody who makes $1.6 million, get your head around that, for a single Instagram post...
Good God.
What he paid for this, which was $68,000, is actually a drop in the ocean, isn't it, really?
It is, yeah.
But this is to advertise her new show. This wasn't really a happy birthday.
Well, they spun it very well then, didn't they?
But, she's pregnant with twins at the moment, so they will have six.
No, that's very
Yeah, they'll have six kids.
Yeah, six. But what, between them? Sorry, six quids. And they're the birth parents to six children, are they? Both?
Well, I think he's got a son from
before, I think he has,
that's
right.
And then they've had three together, and then she's about to give birth to two more.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, good luck to them.
Oh, yeah, sure.
It's you'd have to say that at this time of, the world is really struggling.
Yeah.
The world is in a very troubled place right now. And this is a blatant display of OTT wealth and excess. And it's going to rub people up the wrong way because a lot of people are using food banks right now.
Yeah, well, a lot of people are not going to be able to heat their homes in a couple of months' time. Well, it'll be summer anyway, but next winter certainly. But anyway, there we are, different subject. Now, Christine Lampard, lovely lady. She's 43 this week. And that gives me an excuse, of course, to talk about my team, Everton, because Christine Lampard's husband, Frank Lampard, who is record scorer for Chelsea and had an amazingly successful football career, has been appointed Everton's manager. So whilst Miss Lampard is 43, a mother of their second child, she's going to have a very, very lonely life from now on because Frank Lampard's going to move to Merseyside. He said when he's appointed for Chelsea, this is a 24-hour-a-day job. I don't fancy her chances of getting much of his time over the next couple of years.
Well, it's a dodgy one. I was married to a man who took a job in Poland.
Right.
And he used to fly out there on a Sunday afternoon, immediately after Sunday lunch, to the point that my little three-year-old boy called Sunday lunch Poland food, because his daddy would always go straight out and get in the car and drive off to the airport as soon as lunch was finished. Mm. He was gone all week. He was supposed to come home Friday evenings, but sometimes because of delayed flights, cancellations and so on, he didn't get home till Saturday lunchtime, and then he'd be gone again on Sunday afternoon.
Good gosh.
And it is not a way to live. I had a 10-year-old, a 2-year-old and a newborn baby at the time.
Yeah.
And I was left juggling all of that by myself.
And your career.
Even with nannies and whatever else people have. And I'm sure Christine Lampard's got a team of them coming out of her ears.
Yes.
But there is no substitute for the mum, the dad, the nucleus family. Mm. And they will really struggle with this, I'm sorry to say, because there's no way around it. You've both got to be there all the time when kids are little.
Yeah. If I was him, I'd move lock, stock and barrel to Merseyside and live in a beautiful house in Cheshire, which, of course, is very close by. It's where all the United footballers live. Or somewhere up and down the Fylde coast, you know, somewhere sort of north of Southport or something like that. Because, of course, Christine's family are in Northern Ireland. And
yeah, but her TV career is in London.
Well, it's very true. I mean, look, I'm not undermining her, but her TV career is sporadic, isn't it? She seems to sort of fill in for Lorraine or something.
Maybe it's even sporadic.
Sporadic even. Not sporadic, but sporadic. Yeah, you're
right. I like sporadic. It sounds quite Welsh, doesn't it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I wonder whether, you know, she would flip over to Northern Ireland for 2 or 3 days with the children midweek or something like that and then come back at the weekend after the game and all that kind of stuff. I don't know. But look, it's something that football families have had to deal with all of their lives. You know what I mean? You know, what about Michael Owen when he was playing for Newcastle but actually lived in Harden, which is near Chester, just over the Welsh border? And who sometimes would take helicopters to training and back just so he could maximise family time back in his home 200 miles away, you know?
Yeah, and he became a gambling addict because he was away from his family and he had to have a substitute. You know, there's always a price to pay is what I'm saying.
Yeah, there is. I know.
But the thing I want to ask you about is that you were quite anti-Frank Lampard when it was first mooted that he might be appointed.
Yeah.
You said, didn't you, that he isn't imbued with the essence of the North or with Merseyside, and that how could you take a Londoner, somebody who's so indelibly linked to Chelsea, you'd have to say, and replant him in the North of England and expect him to get what it's like to be a Merseyside.
I totally agree. Now, I said that when I was campaigning to get Wayne Rooney made Everton manager, and I definitely raised the alarm amongst people. I got a bit of a campaign going, but in the end, Wayne turned it down anyway. He said that he thought it was too early and maybe he'll be Everton manager in years to come. But then there was the danger of some deadbeat continental manager who hasn't won anything for about 10 years being drafted in by Mr. Charabishan, who is the world's most powerful football agent and who handles footballers and coaches and literally sort of, you know, goes and offers them to clubs all over the world. So in the end, I'm glad we've got Frank Lampard. The point I made about his Londonness is that he was born and brought up in West Ham, which is East London, and then achieved glory in his career at Chelsea, which is West London, and he hasn't done much outside the M25. However, now that he is Everton manager, he gets my support absolutely 100%. Talking about support, Simon Cowell's fallen off his bike again, Miss Jones. Is this a publicity stunt? Keeps falling off his bike when his shows seem to be crashing.
I don't think so. I mean, he took his show off the air of his own accord. Simon Cowell doesn't need publicity. He doesn't even really care for it.
Yeah.
He never really bothered about how people thought of him. He cultivated a sort of anti-showbiz personality, if you like. He was unpleasant to people all over the place and didn't seem to mind what people thought of him. I think he, of all people, needs publicity less than any of us.
Right.
You know, so I think it literally was just a fall off a bike.
Yeah, well, he needs to start riding properly because those bikes go quite fast and they're very heavy. If they come down on top of you, you could be in real trouble. Have you seen the sort of artwork that old Ronnie Wood turned out? I saw it this morning, a charcoal of a picture he made of the Duke of Edinburgh, and it was remarkably good. I don't know if you've seen it, but
I did see it. It's it's black and white.
Yeah.
It's he sort of copies paintings or photographs and does sort of his own renditions of them.
Mm.
I mean, no offense to Ronnie, he's obviously talented, yeah, but it's not my kind of art. I went to a wake after a funeral of a very dear friend,
yes,
a few years ago now, and the wake was held at Kenny Jones's polo club. Mm. Kenny Jones, famously the drummer with Faces, Small Faces, yes, The Who. And there was a huge kind of mural behind the bar there, mm, that Ronnie had painted for Kenny.
Right.
And Rod Stewart was in it, and it was kind of, I think it was, from memory, a take on The Last Supper, but it had rock stars,
right,
in it, instead of, you know, yeah, the Jesus and the 12 disciples and so, yeah, on. Not my kind of art. There's something a little rough and ready to it, which really appeals to some people.
I still think it's very talented, because the same story that you and I are talking about, he did a sort of Picasso version of the Stones on stage, and you can spot Mick Jagger, even though it's like Picasso inspired, yeah, if you know what I mean.
There is a likeness. Yeah. He did go to art school, he did study the craft. I'm not denigrating him for that reason, but it's just not my style of art. I prefer impressionism, the traditional impressionists and so on. There have been some great programs on TV lately about the impressionists.
Right.
And I'm learning about artists I never even knew existed.
Yeah, no, I used to like going to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, you know, when they had like a special, like a Monet or Manet. I can never separate Monet and Manet. They're from the same period, aren't they?
Two different people.
Yeah, I know two different people, but they...
Both impressionists,
both impressionists,
yeah,
that's right, yeah. So I can never sort of tell them apart. But no, I if there's one area of my life which I failed in absolutely, it's the cultural area of life. I've hardly ever been to a museum, actually. Hardly ever been to an art gallery. You know, I'd love to go to the Louvre, but I've never really found time when I've been in Paris. Or, to put it more bluntly, drinking time when I'm away on a job is much more important to me than cultural time. I can't understand why anybody would go to Paris and then wander around a museum when they could actually go down on the left bank and visit a few bars there, you know?
Oh, how uncouth.
Yeah, I know, it's terribly uncouth.
I lived in Paris for a year when I was a student, and I used to live in the Louvre. Mm. And, you know, there's so much. There's a wealth of art in Paris to explore. You can never see it all.
Yep.
But yeah, I got really into it. I learned something from this TV program the other night, actually. You know the artist people refer to as Degas?
Degas, no. Who's
Degas? Degas, D-E-G-A-S, Degas.
Degas, yeah.
Famous for his paintings and sculptures and pastels of ballerinas. Mm-hmm. His name was actually Degas, and it was two separate words, D-E and then G-A-S, Degas. Yeah. And so the French woman who was commenting on him in the programme kept referring to him as Degas, and the presenter kept saying Degas, and it sounded weird. So I'm now reversing my stance on this artist, and henceforth he shall be known as Degas.
Right. Oh, well, there you go. What was I going to talk to you about? Yeah, I've read a review on a new book on Greta Garbo. Is she the most mysterious woman in the history of Hollywood? I didn't realise until I read this review. She actually went into isolation, retired, and never came out of a flat again in New York at the age of 36.
Yeah, well, she did come out because I had lunch with May Pang, who had an affair with John Lennon, famously, for 18 months. And they used to live, they were neighbours.
Oh, right.
They lived in an apartment.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it was right next door, and they used to see her in the lift and stuff. Really? And she did go out for walks and things.
Amazing.
Yeah. What I'm wondering, does anybody care? Greta Garbo. If I said the name Greta Garbo to my three kids, they'd go, who?
Oh, no. Greta Garbo.
No, honestly, they would not know who she is or was. No. Well, she's no longer in the public consciousness. No. It's very interesting. It's too long ago, Mike.
Yeah, well,
who remembers her films? Can you name one of her films?
Falling in Love Again.
Well, that's not a film.
Sorry?
That's a song. That's a song.
Yeah, but it was Greta Garbo, wasn't it? What am I?
I don't know. But she, you know her period.
Is that the other one? Was that the Swedish one? Falling in Love Again.
Yeah, who was that? It's too long ago. She was a big star in between 1925 and 1941. And you weren't even born then.
Yeah, no, it's true. Yeah, but people...
So that's the Hollywood golden age, and nobody remembers it now. No. Nobody watches those films.
Yeah, but people still write books about, you know, Henry VIII. I mean, it doesn't matter how long ago you were around. If you were a substantial and important person who led, you know, a riveting life, people still write books about them. You write books about John Lennon, you know, and sadly John Lennon's not around anymore, of course.
No, but there are lots of people who still remember him.
Yes,
lots
there are,
of people
yes.
still living. Yes. That's the point. I don't think there's anyone still living who remembers Greta Garbo. Yeah.
No, I'm sure you're right. But anyway, just it fascinated me. Beautiful women always fascinate me, Miss Jones, as you know. Now, I read a story this week about a British Airways plane that got blown off course trying to land at an airport in Scotland somewhere. I can't remember where it was now, probably Aberdeen or somewhere like that.
I saw the footage, absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, yeah.
But didn't you have something like that happen to you?
Absolutely. I was going, believe it or not, I was going to Tucson, Arizona, and I was going there to try and break in to the sex clinic where Michael Douglas was being treated for...
Oh, yeah, I remember that. He was a sex addict.
Yes, that's
he?
Right. He was being treated for sex mania because, you know, his long-standing wife, who he cheated on a number of times, had caught him out again, and part of the deal to save the marriage was he had to check into this sex clinic, you know? It was all very bizarre. But anyway, I go over there so I must have flown from New York, I assume, or I might have gone to Fort Worth, Dallas, or something like that, you know what I mean? But we're flying into Tucson, Arizona, and the airport is between two ranges of hills. And so as we're coming down, you know, if you're looking out of the... I don't usually take a window seat in a plane. I prefer the freedom of being able to move in and out of the aisle when I want to, you know what I mean? But the plane wasn't very packed, so I moved over to the window seat, because of course when you're flying over America there's so much to see. And as we were coming down, you know, I spotted the runway, because runway is quite a big thing, isn't it? And then as I'm glancing at the ground, I suddenly thought, that's strange, the runway's disappeared, and what hove into view was grass, which was the grass next to the runway, and then buildings which seemed to be very, very close to the wheels of the plane. And all of a sudden, there was that moment that you got in Top Gun. Woof, the pilot pulled the old throttle back, and whoosh, we went shooting up again, you know. And then the pilot came on and said, terribly sorry about that. It happens occasionally at Tucson Airport. It's called wind shear, and the wind just whips around one set of hills towards the other, and it sometimes catches the plane. However, nothing to worry about, and we will now make our positive approach. Anyway, we went in again, exactly the same thing happened, but we'd got even closer to the ground. And so we were heading actually for the airport terminal at ground level, you know, about sort of 6 feet off the ground or something. And then, whoosh, you know, the old pilot got going again on the throttles. And it was very, very scary. Anyway, we went up into the air and the pilot said, clearly, you know, wind conditions now, weather conditions are not suitable for landing. The airport's been closed. And we're going to Phoenix. And so we flew on. I think Phoenix is about 120 miles away, and landed in Phoenix. But it was, believe me, when you're in an aeroplane and you realise the aeroplane's completely out of control, it was quite harrowing.
Well, it is. I mean, anything, the slightest thing, you know, when you get a little pocket of turbulence when you're up in the air and so on, I always immediately think, oh, no, this is it. This is the moment.
Yeah.
We're going down. We're going to die.
Yeah.
I think we're all on tenterhooks when we're in the plane anyway.
Well, yeah, I tend to agree with that. I never think about it. Funny enough, I don't like height. I'm very scared of height. I can't stand at the edge of even a balcony in New York, you know what I mean, on an apartment. But I've never been bothered by being in an aeroplane because I really don't think about it. As far as I'm concerned, it's just an environment, you know?
Well, it's at 35,000 feet or whatever
it is.
And it's very precarious. You are basically in a tin can that is subject to the elements in a way that you're not subject to the elements when you're on the ground.
Yeah.
And it's very frightening. Did you ever fly Concorde?
Yes, just the once.
I did several times.
Yeah, no, you didn't tell me.
You know that moment when it goes supersonic,
yes.
Or it did used to, it's never going to again.
No.
And it's a tiny plane. The body of the plane is really small. You've only got two seats either side of a central aisle.
Yes.
And it feels fragile. And then at that moment when it goes supersonic, it seems to explode. The noise is incredible.
It is.
And then you've got that sound for the rest of the time that it's flying supersonically.
Yes.
And you just sit there thinking, how can this thing stay in the air?
Yeah, you know, I totally agree. And there's a screen at the front, isn't there, which shows you the speed. And it suddenly goes Mach 2.
Mach 2, the speed of sound.
That's right, yeah. And then there you are. No, you know, where I live in Stockbroker Belt, Concorde used to come over at 4 o'clock every afternoon. So, you know, if I'd been working in the morning and got home at 2 or 3 o'clock, I used to make sure there was a drink on the table by 3:30 and go out into my roof garden and watch this beautiful big white bird sweep down. It used to kind of sweep down into Surrey and do a U-turn and then go in on the flight path to Heathrow. And it was the most beautiful experience, honestly. You know,
it was magical.
Oh,
yeah.
It's such a wonderful machine.
It was. There was one of them was parked on a ship in the Hudson River,
I think, in
New York.
Yes.
And when my kids, the two younger ones, were little, and we were in New York for a summer because my elder daughter was at the American Academy of Dramatic Art for the summer. So we were all staying over there. So I said right to the kids one day, I'm going to take you on Concorde, and their eyes nearly fell out.
Yeah.
But you could go and visit.
Yes.
You could do a little,
I remember it.
Go, you know, climb in and tour
it.
Around.
I remember it, yeah.
So they are able to say to their friends, to this day they do, that they went on Concorde. But they also were struck by how small it was.
They would
inside.
Be, because on the ground you'd think, how could this ever take off? I totally agree. It was a main experience. Anyway, just to finish my story about Michael, what's his name, and Michael Douglas.
Michael Douglas. Deandra was
Deandra,
his wife's
that's
name
right,
at the
yeah.
time.
Of course, I never got to see Michael Douglas because he was a, quotes, patient.
He was having sex in the back of the clinic.
Yeah, he probably was, that's right, yeah. But I did the usual thing that you and I would have done. I just hung around a load of bars near the hospital and talked to people, you know, orderlies, and paid them lots of dollars to tell me what was going on. Got a great story out of it, you know, about
how
Michael Jackson had to stand up in a group of people and say those immortal words, my name is Michael and I'm a sex addict. You know, he actually had to admit to it before he could get the cure. But anyway.
That's the first step, isn't it? But I will say one thing, whenever you never failed, whenever you set off on a venture like that to get the story, you always got it.
Well, we all did.
Something hugely admirable about that.
No, we all did. If we didn't, we'd have been out of work. Fleet Street was so competitive. So many people wanted those golden jobs that we had, that if you ever came back without a story, you'd had it. You were a failure. You had to succeed. Yeah. And if you didn't, you didn't deserve to be there, frankly. But anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there we are. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself. I was thinking who I was then. With myself, the Porkmeister.
What's my name again?
Yeah, what's my name, yeah. Who was that, by the way? Because your dad covered all the alley fights. Can you remember who that was?
Who's my name again? What's my name again?
Cassius Clay, as he was then. Converted.
What are you? What's your question? Sorry,
my question is: who was the boxer that Cassius Clay took on and kept punching him whilst asking him the question, "What's my name?" Because the boxer would not call Ali Muhammad Ali; he kept calling him Cassius Clay.
Oh, I see. Yeah. You've got me.
It's very obscure, but of course you've done it. His name was George Chavalo, and he was a Canadian, and he baited Ali before the fight by calling him Cassius Clay. So in the ring, Ali could have knocked him down in 2 rounds, seriously. You know, he was that poor. He was just one of those, what they called a bum a month, you know, to keep Ali in shape. And Ali just kept hitting him enough to keep him on his feet. But every time he hit him, what's my name? What's my name? What's my name? And then put him down in about the eighth or something like that. But anyway, there we are. What was I talking about? I'm sorry, you missed that.
I don't know. We went off on a tangent.
We went off on a tangent, yeah. Well, I'll tell you what I was going to tell you. I was going to tell you about a great story about the Spectator magazine, okay? Now, I tried to read the Spectator and the New Statesman every week, okay? Because if I'm doing TV shows which, you know, involve politics, you like to get the point of view from both sides, you know? And you and I both read a lot of newspapers every day and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, 2 weeks ago, because I was busy every day and I was out of town for a couple of days, I forgot to pick up my Spectator. I don't have it sent to the house as a subscription because sometimes I need it before it comes through the post, if you see what I mean. You know, I might need it on the very morning it's come out or the night before even, which you can sometimes get in London.
So you just pick it up at a newsagent?
Yes, I do, yeah, because, you know.
Well, that is a dying art. They're not going to last much longer, are they?
No, they're not. But think about how many stations you and I go through in an ordinary working week. You know what I mean? You get on the train, you get off at London Bridge or you get off at Victoria. There's always a WH Smith at a railway station or an airport in this country. That's ever been so ever since we started travelling. So I got to the Friday and last week's had gone and I thought, what am I going to do? So believe it or not, I wrote to the Spectator office, which is in Old Queen Street, London, Southwest 1, and I sent them a £10 note And I said, you know, dear spectator, due to being busy and travelling last week, I missed my copy of Spectator, which, of course, is now off the shelves. I wonder if you could possibly send it to me, please. I enclose £10 for the cost of the magazine, plus postage and packing. Thank you very much indeed. 2 days later, literally 2 days later, this note came back. It's a card, and it says, "The Spectator, with compliments from the editor's office. Dear Mr. Parry, thank you for your letter and please accept the Spectator magazine with our compliments. I am also enclosing your £10 note. I hope you continue to enjoy reading the magazine. Best wishes, Lynn." So Lynn, I assume, is, you know, an assistant to the editor or runs the office or something like that. But I want to publicly say to them, what a lovely gesture.
What a really lovely gesture. Yes. Yeah, so they have you as a reader for life.
Well, I was always going to be a reader for life, you know, I hope. But I mean, that is just great PR, isn't it? You know,
good on them. They have very generous.
Yeah, exactly. Make you feel warm about it and all that kind of stuff. Now then, Miss Jones, will you be dancing in the aisles as this podcast is about to come out, as we enter the weekend of the celebration of the Queen's 70th from her coronation?
Well, I have huge admiration for Her Majesty the Queen, as I'm sure you know.
Yes.
This is the 70th anniversary of her accession to the throne. There is going to be a gun salute at Cardiff Castle at 12 noon next Monday, which is the actual day, February the 7th. I do admire her. I think she has had a tremendous reign.
I hear a but coming here somewhere.
But, yeah, there's always a but. Mm. I think we should be preparing to dismantle the monarchy. Mm-hmm. Apart from her, they are heaped in shame and vulgarity and overprivilege. Mm. And I think it's time that we let them go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we can't ignore the 70th anniversary of the coronation of the Queen, can we?
No, we're not going to. No, absolutely not. And a platinum jubilee is a platinum jubilee. I hadn't realised, by the way, that Prince William turns 40 during the Queen's platinum jubilee year as well. So he's going to have a low-key 40th because of that, isn't he?
Yeah.
But I think, look, I mean, she could live another 10 years. Mm. She could do. Her mother lived well over 100, didn't she?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
She's very well cared for medically and so on. Mm. So we could easily have her for another 10 years.
Yeah.
God save the Queen. But I think after that, they're no longer relevant to this world. Some of them have shown their contempt for the institution.
Shocking anti-monarchist.
No, I'm not anti-monarchist, but I think in this day and age, they've become tired and they've become irrelevant. And I just don't think they emit the right message to the country in this day and age.
Oh, my God, I can go no further. Now then, Miss Jones, I'm very angry with somebody who's had a can of white paint, which presumably they were going to paint something with, but instead of which they dropped it on the road in front of my house, and I now look like I've got a Banksy on the black tarmac road outside my house. And, of course, as I open the penthouse, I look down on it, and all the cars... And, I mean, this person didn't do anything to clear it up, OK? It looks like he was getting it out of the back of a van and for some unknown reason dropped it, or the handle broke or something. The cam burst, and because of the camber of the road, it's run all over the place. But then, I mean, buses and cars have driven through it. People coming home and turning on the road to go into their driveways have taken the paint up their driveway. I mean, it's a horrendous mess. But if you look at it from where I am up here and look down, it looks like a Banksy. You know, it's that bizarre, but it is absolutely horrible. And it raises the question that in society, sometimes nobody's responsible for putting things right that go wrong, because I can't get any sense out of the council to come and clean it.
Well, that is obviously the responsibility of the decorator who dropped it. Somebody ought to force him to clean that up and put it right.
But nobody knows who it is.
So nobody saw it happen.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly, yeah. You know, things like that. I mean,
well, it must be somebody in your building or close by who was having something decorated.
That's exactly right. Somebody's come to this building to do some work and they're responsible. But I mean, you know, it's not my job to go
around. You can easily find out Well, have you got like a management committee or something?
Yeah, but you know, it's all about time, isn't it? And trying to get it sorted and all that. I'd pay for somebody in the end to come and just clean it up. I do that often.
I hate this kind of thing. Yeah. I'm so particular about this stuff. That, exactly. You know when they paint the lines down the middle of a road?
Yes.
You know when they do that?
Yes.
And then, of course, they don't leave it enough time to dry. Mm. And then, as you say, buses, trucks, yeah. cars all come and yeah. drive through it yeah. and smudge it all over the road.
Yeah.
And that drives me insane, yeah. that kind of thing. I don't want to look at that.
And me. All I want is a neat and tidy neighbourhood. And I think, well, if I just, you know, do my bit and everybody else does their bit, we can't be a problem. So every Sunday morning, you'll find me out in the street with my little litter picker and a bag. And I go up and down the gutter, so to speak. And I've noticed since I started doing it, two or three other, you know, good thinking neighbours have started doing it as well. And that, you know, that breeds a sense of community. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it does. I'm really sorry for you. I hope you get this sorted
out. Well, we will get it sorted out in the end, because I've had this problem before in places where I live. I wait long enough for the, you know, either the managing agent or the local council to do something about it. And when they don't, I just get it done myself and I just pay for it. You know, it might cost a few hundred quid or something like that, but I would rather stare down on a black road again rather than this terrible white mess. You know what I mean? Because in the end, I think there's going to have to paint yeah. over it. But anyway, you know.
It's very irresponsible. Of course, all those people who drove through it and then drove it onto their own driveways as well,
yeah.
they've got it all over the tyres of their cars.
They have. Well, that won't last for long, because that'll wear off eventually, won't it? But it won't be for a while. You're absolutely right. Tyres don't wear very quickly, you know, as we all know. So, and it's gone onto the pavement. It's been splashed onto the pavement. It's just a horrendous mess, you know. And the person I most dislike is the person. Look, I'm not saying that whoever dropped it could then suddenly have got a mop and bucket and wiped it up. You can't. It's thick Dulux paint. But they should have had the responsibility to alert somebody, to get something done. Their employers presumably have funds to be able to deal with these sort of things, you know. But anyway, look, what am I moaning about?
I mean, somebody should track him down and make him deal with it.
Those things take time. That's the problem. Now then, I'm going to keep moaning, and this isn't a moan fest, but I'm having to get my robe tooth removed after £2,500 worth of work, Miss Jones.
Well, that's awful, and I think that your dentist is culpable.
No, I don't think he is.
I'm going to tell you a story here. My daughter Mia had her veneers redone. She came off a bike over the handlebars some years ago when she was a little girl. Mm. And so she sadly had to have her four front teeth remade.
Mm.
And over the years, they wear out, as you know, and they have to be redone. She recently had her veneers redone.
Yeah.
And something bizarre happened. The veneers weren't thick enough, I think. They were too opaque.
Right.
And the cement...
Sorry, what is a veneer? Is that a false tooth?
It's like a cap, I suppose.
Oh,
it's a casing of a tooth that fits over your original.
I see.
They file them down to stumps.
Yeah, I see.
And then they fit these veneers over the top.
Yeah, okay.
The cement that they used, in this case, it oxidized.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows through the front teeth like black patches.
Oh, golly.
And it cost her £3,500.
Mm.
And she's had to go back to that dentist and have them looked at. And in fact, the dentist has now agreed to refund the money.
Right.
And Mia's having to go off to a cosmetic dentist at double the cost. So we're talking £7,000 now to have the whole thing redone again.
It's terrible.
Which is very traumatic as well. And you're still in pain after £2,500 worth of dental work.
Yeah.
Mia's dentist had to refund the money, and I think you'll find that your dentist has to as well.
Well, it's not quite as simple as that, and I do appreciate your sentiment, and that should happen. But I went, first of all, to see him about a cracked filling. I've told this story actually on this podcast before. I'll just recap very quickly. Last black filling in the back of my mouth cracked. I went to see him. I said, put a crown on it, no problem. Put the crown on. The crown was never comfortable. It was always you bit on it, you felt pain in your tooth, you know. So I went back and he filed it down a little bit more, nothing. Third time, he said, look, we're going to have to give this root canal surgery. He said, but I prefer to send my patients to Harley Street to a specialist clinic. I said, fine, that costs £1,200. Yeah, well, the crown had already cost £1,000. And they did the root canal stuff, and I thought, that's brilliant. You know, that was an hour and 10-minute operation, but it'd be good. A few days later, the pain was still with me. Went back to see my original dentist. He said, there must be something wrong with the ligaments. You know, I'll try some more work on it and all that. Anyway, that was before Christmas. And my dentist, who is a really great guy, by the way, he's not just a dentist, he's a doctor of, you know, odontology or whatever. And he's done everything. He's treated me for the last 25 years. I've never had a complaint. And I don't believe for a moment, A, he's been incompetent, or B, he's done anything wrong. What he said to me is, he said, we can't really understand it, neither myself nor the Harley Street surgeon, but if it's still giving you pain, the only alternative now is to take it out. Then at some future date, think about putting in an implant. It's just one of those things. It's just life. I mean, you know, I say to myself, I'm bloody lucky to be able to afford to spend $2,500 on a tooth, because some people in life will have the problem I've got and won't be able to spend 25 quid on it and will live with it for life, you know? But I've read that only this morning that people, you know, are now so wary of going to dentists because of the cost that they just suffer pain.
Well, my mother told me on Sunday that her younger sister, who's my aunt, has been doing her own dentistry. Yeah. This is an 84-year-old lady, and she's gone and got a little pot of some kind of pink cement stuff from Boots.
Yes.
And when her fillings came out, she's been sticking them back in herself. I think that's absolutely appalling.
It is appalling. I mean, it's dreadful. I've never heard anything like it. Honestly, it's horrible. Did you see that Joanna Lumley has spoken out about mental health and said to some people, look, you know, of course there's genuine mental health, but also a lot of people jumping on the bandwagon when they come to a minor problem in life and start crying mental health. I do have sympathy with that point of view.
Yeah, I think it's a catch-all excuse now, isn't it? Which is not to take away from people who are genuine sufferers.
Yeah.
But I think in cases of employment disputes, that kind of thing, it's very easy to pull the mental health card.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's a no-win situation if you oppose it, really, isn't it? Because then, you know, you're exacerbating the mental health of my clients and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's a catch-all phrase these days. But I thought Joanna Lumley was very brave to speak out. And funny enough, after she spoke out, she got a load of abuse and all that. And then Celia Walden jumped in her column in the Daily Telegraph, and supported Joanna Lumley. So I thought, well, you know, there is another side to this then. It's not just me who thinks that Joanna Lumley had a point. Celia Walden writes a lovely column. She's of course, Piers's wife, isn't she?
She is, yes. And there are all kinds of points of views, but I do think that if somebody doesn't have a history of mental health issues and suddenly something goes wrong at school, college, work, whatever,
very good point.
And out of the ether, they suddenly come up with a mental health crisis, I think that is to be questioned.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. Now, I had a strange but wonderful experience this week, Miss Jones. I've turned up for a TV show, okay? And I'm talking to the researchers before, as you do, we're sitting there, and they were asking me the strangest questions, like, you know, what do you think of are the best girls' names? What do you think are the best boys' names? And I said, what do you mean? You know, if you had a child and you were going to get it christened, what names would you go for? Would you tell any of your friends the sex of your baby if your wife was having a baby? Would you tell your friends the name you'd chosen for your baby before other people stole it and gave it to them? I thought, what's going on here? You know, and I asked all these questions. Then I was asked other questions about childcare and the responsibility of parenthood, okay? So
all of which you have vast experience at, Mr. Parry.
I made it clear from the start. A, I've never been married. B, I've never had children, so I've never had to select a child's name. Anyway, we get on to the set, and the host is a lovely lady called Storm Huntley, okay? And she's hosting the show, and, you know, just right at the start, and she then suddenly announces that she and her husband are having their first child, and she's just found out that she's going to be a mother, and motherhood is going to, and I've never seen such a happy environment, honestly. You know what I mean? I don't know how you ever announced, you know, when you were expectant and the joy you felt and how people reacted to you, but I mean, I have never seen anything like it. There were female employees in this TV studio who were crying with joy. You know what I mean?
or maybe even jealousy.
Really?
It's a difficult one, isn't it? Yes, there is a rule of thumb in the maternity world, if we can call it that, that says that one should never come out with the news until you've had your 3-month scan, just in case there's anything wrong.
I think in Storm's case, it's 16 weeks.
Right, so she's well past that. Yeah. She's okay then. And she's also young and very strong and fit and so on. Interestingly, she's recently announced her new job. So it's in the old days.
No, she was doing her new job. This was part of her new job.
Right, she's doing her new job. Yeah. So in the old days, we would have kept that news quiet. Pregnant women would have kept that news quiet because we wouldn't want to risk our employment. Nowadays, you can't be fired for being pregnant.
No, I totally.
It's a very different world.
Totally accept what you're saying there. Mind you, the organisation, and it's ITM Productions, are, I've always found them to be great employers. You know what I mean? They have great HR policies, and they're inclusive to their work staff and all that kind of stuff. So didn't surprise me at all that she was so joyed. But even though, you know, I'm a man and obviously I'll never give birth to a woman, the sheer joy that
or indeed a man.
I mean, like a woman, obviously. But what I'm saying is it was lovely to be part of that announcement because it brought everybody so much joy, so much goodwill, everybody feeling for her. And, you know, some of her friends were texting her because they'd seen it announced on television and all that kind of stuff. And I just felt so happy and so pleased for Storm because she's a lovely girl anyway. I've worked with her for a couple of years now, very professional, you know, very intelligent, very straightforward. So I really did. It was a moment of sheer joy, and I felt very warm about it a few hours afterwards. And so I suppose what I'm saying is I've never really appreciated the joyful concept of about to become a parent could make people, not just the mother to be and the father to be, but other people, make them feel so joyful.
I think there is something, especially now with the world in turmoil, about the delivery of new life. You know, it is a miracle, even with all the medical explanations and everything else. The fact that we can grow a human being inside our own body and bring it into the world, and it'll be an independent, living, breathing being one day after we've brought it up. There is still something miraculous about
that. There is, I agree.
Humanity cannot explain. Yeah. But what it really is to me is a symbol of hope. You know, a new child, a new generation. It's humanity marching on and coming through all the current problems and troubles and the fact that our race will continue. It's symbolic of all those things. It's not only joyful to the parents themselves and to the expectant mother, but it's joyful for all of us, if that doesn't sound trite.
No, I totally agree. I accept everything you're saying there. Do you do christenings at St. Bride's?
Yeah, of course we do. Lots and lots of
Christenings. That's what I mean. So you'll have witnessed all this then, you know, the proud parents beaming and all that kind of stuff,
We've had quite a lot of celebrity baptisms as well.
Oh, yes?
Because, you know, being the journalist church.
Yeah.
Kate Silverton, for example, had her children baptised at St. Bride's. All three of mine were done there, of course, and confirmed as well.
Yeah, golly, that's fantastic, isn't it? So there you go. Right, very uplifting end to this week's podcast. Okay, Miss Jones, well, thank you very much indeed for your time. Thank you to all our millions of listeners. Stick with us, please. As we're recording this, certainly from my end, Miss Jones, the sun is shining brightly, and I think spring is probably just around the corner. But I do love the milky sun of a winter's day. I shall be out walking on the North Downs later.
Definitely. I'll be right behind you.
Very good. Okay, folks, that's it for now. See you again this time next week.
If I said the name Greta Garbo to my three kids, they'd go, who?
Oh, no. Greta Garbo.
No, honestly, they would not know who she is or was. No. Well, she's no longer in the public consciousness. It's very interesting. It's too long ago, Mike.
Yeah, well, you
who remembers her films? Can you name one of her films?
Falling in Love Again.
That's not a film.
Sorry?
That's a song. That's a song.
Yeah, but it was Greta Garbo, wasn't it?
What am I? I don't know. But she, you know her period
of... Was that the other one? Was that the Swedish one? Falling in love again.
Yeah, who was that? It's too long ago. She was a big star in between 1925 and 1941. And you weren't even born then.
Yeah, no, it's true.
she's very well cared for medically and so on. So we could easily have her for another 10 years.
Yeah.
God save the Queen. But I think after that, they're no longer relevant to this world. Some of them have shown their contempt for the institution.
Shocking anti-monarchist.
No, I'm not anti-monarchist, but I think in this day and age, they've become tired and they've become irrelevant. And I just don't think they emit the right message to the country in this day and age.
Oh my God, I can go no further. Even though, you know, I'm a man and obviously I'll never give birth to a woman, the sheer joy that...
or indeed a man.
No, exactly, yeah, sorry, yeah, I mean, like a woman, obviously.